Chapter 95. The Hashashin arranged his unconscious trophy in the rear of the van and took a moment to admire her sprawled body. She was not as beautiful as the women he bought, and yet she had an animal strength that excited him. Her body was radiant, dewy with perspiration. She smelled of musk. As the Hashashin stood there savoring his prize, he ignored the throb in his arm. The bruise from the falling sarcophagus, although painful, was insignificant, well worth the compensation that lay before him. He took consolation in knowing the American who had done this to him was probably dead by now. Gazing down at his incapacitated prisoner, the Hashashin visualized what lay ahead. He ran a palm up beneath her shirt. Her breasts felt perfect beneath her bra. "Yes," he smiled. "You are more than worthy." Fighting the urge to take her right there, he closed the door and drove off into the night. There was no need to alert the press about this killing. The flames would do that for him. At CERN, Sylvie sat stunned by the Camerlengo's address. Never before had she felt so proud to be a Catholic, and so ashamed to work at CERN. As she left the recreational wing, the mood in every single viewing room was dazed and somber. When she got back to Kohler's office, all 7 phone lines were ringing. Media inquiries were never routed to Kohler's office, so the incoming calls could only be one thing. Geld. Money calls. Antimatter technology already had some takers. Inside the Vatican, Gunther Glick was walking on air as he followed the Camerlengo from the Sistine Chapel. Glick and Macri had just made the live transmission of the decade. And what a transmission it had been. The Camerlengo had been spellbinding. Now, out in the hallway, the Camerlengo turned to Glick and Macri. "I have asked the Swiss Guard to assemble photos for you. Photos of the branded cardinals, as well as one of his late holiness. I must warn you, these are not pleasant pictures. Ghastly burns, blackened tongues. But I would like you to broadcast them to the world." Glick decided it must be perpetual Christmas inside Vatican City. "He wants me to broadcast an exclusive photo of the dead Pope." "Are you sure?" Glick asked, trying to keep the excitement from his voice. The Camerlengo nodded. "The Swiss Guard will also provide you a live video feed of the antimatter canister as it counts down." Glick stared. "Christmas! Christmas! Christmas!" "The Illuminati are about to find out," the Camerlengo declared, "that they have grossly overplayed their hand." Chapter 96. Like a recurring theme in some demonic symphony, the suffocating darkness had returned. No light, no air, no exit. Langdon lay trapped beneath the overturned sarcophagus and felt his mind careening dangerously close to the brink. Trying to drive his thoughts in any direction other than the crushing space around him, Langdon urged his mind toward some logical process, mathematics, music, anything. But there was no room for calming thoughts. "I can't move. I can't breathe." The pinched sleeve of his jacket had thankfully come free when the casket fell, leaving Langdon now with 2 mobile arms. Even so, as he pressed upward on the ceiling of his tiny cell, he found it immovable. Oddly, he wished his sleeve were still caught. At least it might create a crack for some air. As Langdon pushed against the roof above, his sleeve fell back to reveal the faint glow of an old friend, Mickey. The greenish cartoon face seemed mocking now. Langdon probed the blackness for any other sign of light, but the casket rim was flush against the floor. "Goddamn Italian perfectionists," he cursed, now imperiled by the same artistic excellence he taught his students to revere. impeccable edges, faultless parallels, and, of course, use only the most seamless and resilient Carrara marble. Precision can be suffocating. "Lift the damn thing," he said aloud, pressing harder through the tangle of bones. The box shifted slightly. Setting his jaw, he heaved again. The box felt like a boulder, but this time it raised a quarter of an inch. A fleeting glimmer of light surrounded him, and then the casket thudded back down. Langdon lay panting in the dark. He tried to use his legs to lift, as he had before, but now that the sarcophagus had fallen flat, there was no room even to straighten his knees. As the claustrophobic panic closed in, Langdon was overcome by images of the sarcophagus shrinking around him. Squeezed by delirium, he fought the illusion with every logical shred of intellect he had. "Sarcophagus," he stated aloud, with as much academic sterility as he could muster. But even erudition seemed to be his enemy today. "Sarcophagus" is from the Greek sarx, meaning flesh, and phagein, meaning to eat. I'm trapped in a box literally designed to eat flesh. Images of flesh eaten from bone only served as a grim reminder that Langdon lay covered in human remains. The notion brought nausea and chills, but it also brought an idea. Fumbling blindly around the coffin, Langdon found a shard of bone. A rib, maybe? He didn't care. All he wanted was a wedge. If he could lift the box, even a crack, and slide the bone fragment beneath the rim, then maybe enough air could... Reaching across his body and wedging the tapered end of the bone into the crack between the floor and coffin, Langdon reached up with his other hand and heaved skyward. The box didn't move, not even slightly. He tried again. For a moment it seemed to tremble slightly, but that was all. With the fetid stench and lack of oxygen choking the strength from his body, Langdon realized he only had time for one more effort. He also knew he would need both arms. Regrouping, he placed the tapered edge of the bone against the crack, and shifting his body, he wedged the bone against his shoulder, pinning it in place. Careful not to dislodge it, he raised both hands above him. As the stifling confine began to smother him, he felt a welling of intensified panic. It was the second time today he had been trapped with no air. Hollering aloud, Langdon thrust upward in one explosive motion. The casket jostled off the floor for an instant, but long enough. The bone shard he had braced against his shoulders slipped outward into the widening crack. When the casket fell again, the bone shattered. But this time Langdon could see the casket was propped up. A tiny slit of light showed beneath the rim. Exhausted, Langdon collapsed. Hoping the strangling sensation in his throat would pass, he waited. But it only worsened as the seconds passed. Whatever air was coming through the slit seemed imperceptible. Langdon wondered if it would be enough to keep him alive, and if so, for how long? If he passed out, who would know he was even in there? With arms like lead, Langdon raised his watch again. 10:12 p.m. Fighting trembling fingers, he fumbled with the watch and made his final play. He twisted one of the tiny dials and pressed a button. As consciousness faded and the walls squeezed closer, Langdon felt the old fears sweep over him. He tried to imagine, as he had so many times, that he was in an open field. The image he conjured, however, was no help. The nightmare that had haunted him since his youth came crashing back. "The flowers here are like paintings," the child thought, laughing as he ran across the meadow. He wished his parents had come along, but his parents were busy pitching camp. "Don't explore too far," his mother had said. He had pretended not to hear as he bounded off into the woods. Now, traversing this glorious field, the boy came across a pile of field stones. He figured it must be the foundation of an old homestead. He would not go near it. He knew better. Besides, his eyes had been drawn to something else, a brilliant lady's slipper, the rarest and most beautiful flower in New Hampshire. He had only ever seen them in books. Excited, the boy moved toward the flower. He knelt down. The ground beneath him felt mulchy and hollow. He realized this flower had found an extra fertile spot. It was growing from a patch of rotting wood. Thrilled by the thought of taking home his prize, the boy reached out, fingers extending toward the stem. He never reached it. With a sickening crack, the earth gave way. In 3 seconds of dizzying terror as he fell, the boy knew he would die. Plummeting downward, he braced for the bone-crushing collision. When it came, there was no pain, only softness and cold. He hit the deep liquid face first, plunging into a narrow blackness. Spinning disoriented somersaults, he groped the sheer walls that enclosed him on all sides. Somehow, as if by instinct, he sputtered to the surface. Light, faint, above him. Miles above him, it seemed. His arms clawed at the water, searching the walls of the hollow for something to grab onto. Only smooth stone. He had fallen through an abandoned well covering. He screamed for help, but his cries reverberated in the tight shaft. He called out again and again. Above him, the tattered hole grew dim. Night fell. Time seemed to contort in the darkness. Numbness set in as he treaded water in the depths of the chasm, calling, crying out. He was tormented by visions of the walls collapsing in, burying him alive. His arms ached with fatigue. A few times he thought he heard voices. He shouted out, but his own voice was muted, like a dream. As the night wore on, the shaft deepened. The walls inched quietly inward. The boy pressed out against the enclosure, pushing it away. Exhausted, he wanted to give up. And yet he felt the water buoy him, cooling his burning fears until he was numb. When the rescue team arrived, they found the boy barely conscious. He had been treading water for 5 hours. 2 days later, the Boston Globe ran a front-page story called The Little Swimmer That Could. Chapter 97. The Hashashin smiled as he pulled his van into the mammoth stone structure overlooking the Tiber River. He carried his prize up and up, spiraling higher in the stone tunnel, grateful his load was slender. He arrived at the door. "The Church of Illumination," he gloated. "The ancient Illuminati meeting room. Who would have imagined it to be here?" Inside, he placed her on a plush divan. Then he expertly bound her arms behind her back and tied her feet. He knew that what he longed for would have to wait until his final task was finished. Water. Still, he thought, he had a moment for indulgence. Kneeling beside her, he ran his hand along her thigh. It was smooth. Higher. His dark fingers snaked beneath the cuff of her shorts. Higher. He stopped. "Patience," he told himself, feeling aroused. "There is work to be done." He walked for a moment out onto the chamber's high stone balcony. The evening breeze slowly cooled his ardor. Far below, the Tiber raged. He raised his eyes to the dome of St. Peter's, 3/4 of a mile away, naked under the glare of the hundreds of press lights. "Your final hour," he said aloud, picturing the thousands of Muslims slaughtered during the Crusades. "At midnight, you will meet your God." Behind him, the woman stirred. The Hashashin turned. He considered letting her wake up. Seeing terror in a woman's eyes was his ultimate aphrodisiac. He opted for prudence. It would be better if she remained unconscious while he was gone. Although she was tied and would never escape, the Hashashin didn't want to return and find her exhausted from struggling. "I want your strength preserved. For me." Lifting her head slightly, he placed his palm beneath her neck and found the hollow directly beneath her skull. The crown meridian pressure point was the one he had used countless times. With crushing force, he drove his thumb into the soft cartilage and felt it depress. The woman slumped instantly. 20 minutes, he thought. She would be a tantalizing end to a perfect day. After she had served him and died doing it, he would stand on the balcony and watch the midnight Vatican fireworks. Leaving his prize unconscious on the couch, the Hashashin went downstairs into a torchlit dungeon. The final task. He walked to the table and revered the sacred metal forms that had been left there for him. Water. It was his last. Removing a torch from the wall, as he had done 3 times already, he began heating the end. When the end of the object was white hot, he carried it to the cell. Inside, a single man stood in silence, old and alone. "Cardinal Baja," the killer hissed, "have you prayed yet?" The Italian's eyes were fearless. "Only for your soul." Chapter 98. The 6 Pompieri firemen who responded to the fire at the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria extinguished the bonfire with blasts of halon gas. Water was cheaper, but the steam it created would have ruined the frescoes in the chapel. And the Vatican paid Roman Pompieri a healthy stipend for swift and prudent service in all Vatican-owned buildings. Pompieri, by the nature of their work, witnessed tragedy almost daily. But the execution in this church was something none of them would ever forget. Part crucifixion, part hanging, part burning at the stake. The scene was something dredged from a Gothic nightmare. Unfortunately, the press, as usual, had arrived before the fire department. They'd shot plenty of video before the Pompieri cleared the church. When the firemen finally cut the victim down and laid him on the floor, there was no doubt who the man was. "Cardinale Guidera," one whispered, "di Barcelona." The victim was nude. The lower half of his body was crimson-black, blood oozing through gaping cracks in his thighs. His shin bones were exposed. One fireman vomited. Another went outside to breathe. The true horror, though, was the symbol seared on the cardinal's chest. The squad chief circled the corpse in awestruck dread. "Lavoro del diavolo," he said to himself. "Satan himself did this." He crossed himself for the first time since childhood. "Un altro corpo," someone yelled. One of the firemen had found another body. The second victim was a man the chief recognized immediately. The austere commander of the Swiss Guard was a man for whom few public law enforcement officials had any affection. The chief called the Vatican, but all the circuits were busy. He knew it didn't matter. The Swiss Guard would hear about this on television in a matter of minutes. As the chief surveyed the damage, trying to recreate what possibly could have gone on here, he saw a niche riddled with bullet holes. A coffin had been rolled off its supports and fallen upside down in an apparent struggle. It was a mess. "That's for the police and Holy See to deal with," the chief thought, turning away. As he turned, though, he stopped. Coming from the coffin, he heard a sound. It was not a sound any fireman ever liked to hear. "Bomba!" he cried out. "Tutti fuori!" When the bomb squad rolled the coffin over, they discovered the source of the electronic beeping. They stared, confused. "Medico!" one finally screamed. "Medico!" Chapter 99. "Any word from Olivetti?" the Camerlengo asked, looking drained as Rocher escorted him back from the Sistine Chapel to the Pope's office. "No, signore. I'm feeling the worst." When they reached the Pope's office, the Camerlengo's voice was heavy. "Captain, there is nothing more I can do here tonight. I fear I have done too much already. I am going into this office to pray. I do not wish to be disturbed. The rest is in God's hands. Yes, signore. The hour is late, Captain. Find that canister. Our search continues. Roche hesitated. The weapon proves to be too well hidden. The Camerlengo winced, as if he could not think of it. Yes. At exactly 11:15 p.m., if the church is still in peril, I want you to evacuate the cardinals. I am putting their safety in your hands. I ask only one thing. Let these men proceed from this place with dignity. Let them exit into St. Peter's Square and stand side by side with the rest of the world. I do not want the last image of this church to be frightened old men sneaking out a back door. Very good, signore. And you? Shall I come for you at 11:15 as well? There will be no need. Signore? I will leave when the spirit moves me. Roche wondered if the Camerlengo intended to go down with the ship. The Camerlengo opened the door to the Pope's office and entered. Actually, he said, turning, there is one thing. Signore, there seems to be a chill in this office tonight. I am trembling. The electric heat is out. Let me lay you a fire. The Camerlengo smiled tiredly. Thank you. Thank you very much. Roche exited the Pope's office, where he had left the Camerlengo praying by firelight in front of a small statue of the Blessed Mother Mary. It was an eerie sight, a black shadow kneeling in the flickering glow. As Roche headed down the hall, a guard appeared, running toward him. Even by candlelight, Roche recognized Lieutenant Chartrand, young, green, and eager. Captain! Chartrand called, holding out a cellular phone. I think the Camerlengo's address may have worked. We've got a caller here who says he has information that can help us. He phoned on one of the Vatican's private extensions. I have no idea how he got the number. Roche stopped. What? He will only speak to the ranking officer. Any word from Olivetti? No, sir. He took the receiver. This is Captain Roche. I am ranking officer here. The voice said, Roche, I will explain to you who I am, then I will tell you what you are going to do next. When the caller stopped talking and hung up, Roche stood stunned. He now knew from whom he was taking orders. Back at CERN, Sylvie Badaloc was frantically trying to keep track of all the licensing inquiries coming in on Kohler's voicemail. When the private line on the director's desk began to ring, Sylvie jumped. Nobody had that number. She answered, Yes?
Miss Badaloc, this is Director Kohler. Contact my pilot. My jet is to be ready in 5 minutes.
Chapter 100. Robert Langdon had no idea where he was or how long he had been unconscious when he opened his eyes and found himself staring up at the underside of a Baroque frescoed cupola. Smoke drifted overhead. Something was covering his mouth. An oxygen mask. He pulled it off. There was a terrible smell in the room, like burning flesh. Langdon winced at the pounding in his head. He tried to sit up. A man in white was kneeling beside him.
Riposati, the man said, easing Langdon onto his back again. Sono il paramedico.
Langdon succumbed, his head spiraling like the smoke overhead. What the hell happened? Wispy feelings of panic sifted through his mind.
Sorcio Salvatore, the paramedic said. Mouse, savior.
Langdon felt even more lost.
Mouse, savior?
The man motioned to the Mickey Mouse watch on Langdon's wrist. Langdon's thoughts began to clear. He remembered setting the alarm. As he stared absently at the watch face, Langdon also noted the hour, 10:28 p.m. He sat bolt upright. Then it all came back. Langdon stood near the main altar with the fire chief and a few of his men. They had been rattling him with questions. Langdon wasn't listening.
He had questions of his own. His whole body ached, but he knew he needed to act immediately. A pompiero approached Langdon across the church. "I checked again, sir. The only bodies we found are Cardinal Guidera and the Swiss Guard commander. There's no sign of a woman here."
"Grazie," Langdon said, unsure whether he was relieved or horrified.
He knew he had seen Vittoria unconscious on the floor. Now she was gone. The only explanation he came up with was not a comforting one.
The killer had not been subtle on the phone. "A woman of spirit, I am aroused. Perhaps before this night is over, I will find you, and when I do..."
Langdon looked around. "Where is the Swiss Guard?"
"Still no contact. Vatican lines are jammed."
Langdon felt overwhelmed and alone. Olivetti was dead. The Cardinal was dead. Vittoria was missing. A half hour of his life had disappeared in a blink. Outside, Langdon could hear the press swarming. He suspected footage of the third cardinal's horrific death would no doubt air soon, if it hadn't already. Langdon hoped the Camerlengo had long since assumed the worst and taken action. "Evacuate the damn Vatican. Enough games. We lose." Langdon suddenly realized that all of the catalysts that had been driving him, helping to save Vatican City, rescuing the four cardinals, coming face to face with the Brotherhood he had studied for years, all of these things had evaporated from his mind. The war was lost. A new compulsion had ignited within him. It was simple, stark, primal. Find Vittoria. He felt an unexpected emptiness inside. Langdon had often heard that intense situations could unite two people in ways that decades together often did not. He now believed it. In Vittoria's absence, he felt something he had not felt in years. Loneliness. The pain gave him strength. Pushing all else from his mind, Langdon mustered his concentration. He prayed that the Hashashin would take care of business before pleasure. Otherwise, Langdon knew he was already too late. "No," he told himself, "you have time." Vittoria's captor still had work to do. He had to surface one last time before disappearing forever. The last altar of science, Langdon thought. The killer had one final task. Earth, air, fire, water. He looked at his watch. 30 minutes. Langdon moved past the fireman toward Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa. This time, as he stared at Bernini's marker, Langdon had no doubt what he was looking for. "Let angels guide you on your lofty quest." Directly over the recumbent saint, against a backdrop of gilded flame, hovered Bernini's angel. The angel's hand clutched a pointed spear of fire. Langdon's eyes followed the direction of the shaft, arcing toward the right side of the church. His eyes hit the wall. He scanned the spot where the spear was pointing. There was nothing there. Langdon knew, of course, the spear was pointing far beyond the wall, into the night, somewhere across Rome. "What direction is that?" Langdon asked, turning and addressing the chief with a newfound determination.
"Direction?"
The chief glanced where Langdon was pointing. He sounded confused.
"I don't know. West, I think."
"What churches are in that direction?" The chief's puzzlement seemed to deepen.
"Dozens. Why?"
Langdon frowned. Of course there were dozens.
"I need a city map right away."
The chief sent someone running out to the fire truck for a map. Langdon turned back to the statue.
"Earth, air, fire, Vittoria."
"The final marker is water," he told himself. "Bernini's water. It was in a church out there somewhere. A needle in a haystack." He spurred his mind through all the Bernini works he could recall. "I need a tribute to water." Langdon flashed on Bernini's statue of Triton, the Greek god of the sea. Then he realized it was located in the square outside this very church, in entirely the wrong direction. He forced himself to think. What figure would Bernini have carved as a glorification of water? Neptune and Apollo? Unfortunately, that statue was in London's Victoria and Albert Museum.
"Signore?"
The fireman ran in with a map. Langdon thanked him and spread it out on the altar. He immediately realized he had asked the right people. The fire department's map of Rome was as detailed as any Langdon had ever seen.
"Where are we now?" the man pointed. "Next to Piazza Barberini."
Langdon looked at the angel's spear again to get his bearings. The chief had estimated correctly. According to the map, the spear was pointing west. Langdon traced a line from his current location west across the map. Almost instantly, his hopes began to sink. It seemed that with every inch his finger traveled, he passed yet another building marked with a tiny black cross. Churches. The city was riddled with them. Finally, Langdon's finger ran out of churches and trailed off into the suburbs of Rome. He exhaled and stepped back from the map.
Damn!
Surveying the whole of Rome, Langdon's eyes touched down on the three churches where the first three cardinals had been killed. The Chigi Chapel, St. Peter's, here. Seeing them all laid out before him now, Langdon noted an oddity in their locations. Somehow he had imagined the churches would be scattered randomly across Rome, but they most definitely weren't. Improbably, the three churches seemed to be separated systematically in an enormous citywide triangle. Langdon double-checked. He wasn't imagining things.
"Penna,"
he said suddenly, without looking up. Someone handed him a ballpoint pen. Langdon circled the three churches. His pulse quickened. He triple-checked his markings. A symmetrical triangle. Langdon's first thought was for the great seal on the $1 bill, the triangle containing the all-seeing eye. But it didn't make sense. He had only marked three points. There were supposed to be four in all. So where the hell is water? Langdon knew that anywhere he placed the fourth point, the triangle would be destroyed. The only option to retain the symmetry was to place the fourth marker inside the triangle, at the center. He looked at the spot on the map. Nothing. The idea bothered him anyway. The four elements of science were considered equal. Water was not special. Water would not be at the center of the others. Still, his instinct told him the systematic arrangement could not possibly be accidental. I'm not yet seeing the whole picture. There was only one alternative. The four points did not make a triangle. They made some other shape. Langdon looked at the map. A square, perhaps? Although a square made no symbolic sense, squares were symmetrical, at least. Langdon put his finger on the map at one of the points that would turn the triangle into a square. He saw immediately that a perfect square was impossible. The angles of the original triangle were oblique and created more of a distorted quadrilateral. As he studied the other possible points around the triangle, something unexpected happened. He noticed that the line he had drawn earlier to indicate the direction of the angel's spear passed perfectly through one of the possibilities. Stupefied, Langdon circled that point. He was now looking at four ink marks on the map, arranged in somewhat of an awkward kite-like diamond. He frowned. Diamonds were not an Illuminati symbol, either. He paused. Then again, for an instant, Langdon flashed on the famed Illuminati diamond. The thought, of course, was ridiculous. He dismissed it. Besides, this diamond was oblong, like a kite, hardly an example of the flawless symmetry for which the Illuminati diamond was revered. When he leaned in to examine where he had placed the final mark, Langdon was surprised to find that the fourth point lay dead center of Rome's famed Piazza Navona. He knew the piazza contained a major church, but he had already traced his finger through that piazza and considered the church there. To the best of his knowledge, it contained no Bernini works. The church was called St. Agnes in Agony, named for St. Agnes, a ravishing teenage virgin banished to a life of sexual slavery for refusing to renounce her faith. There must be something in that church. Langdon racked his brain, picturing the inside of the church. He could think of no Bernini works at all inside, much less anything to do with water. The arrangement on the map was bothering him, too. A diamond. It was far too accurate to be coincidence, but it was not accurate enough to make any sense. A kite? Langdon wondered if he had chosen the wrong point. What am I missing? The answer took another 30 seconds to hit him. But when it did, Langdon felt an exhilaration like nothing he had ever experienced in his academic career. The Illuminati genius, it seemed, would never cease. The shape he was looking at was not intended as a diamond at all. The four points only formed a diamond, because Langdon had connected the adjacent points. The Illuminati believe in opposites. Connecting opposite vertices with his pen, Langdon's fingers were trembling. There before him on the map was a giant cruciform. It's a cross. The four elements of science unfolded before his eyes, sprawled across Rome in an enormous citywide cross. As he stared in wonder, a line of poetry rang in his mind, like an old friend with a new face. Cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. Cross Rome. The fog began to clear. Langdon saw that the answer had been in front of him all night. The Illuminati poem had been telling him how the altars were laid out. A cross. Cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. It was cunning wordplay. Langdon had originally read the word cross as an abbreviation of a cross. He assumed it was poetic license, intended to retain the meter of the poem. But it was so much more than that. Another hidden clue. The cruciform on the map, Langdon realized, was the ultimate Illuminati duality. It was a religious symbol formed by elements of science. Galileo's path of illumination was a tribute to both God and science. The rest of the puzzle fell into place almost immediately. Piazza Navona. Dead center of Piazza Navona, outside the Church of St. Agnes in Agony, Bernini had forged one of his most celebrated sculptures. Everyone who came to Rome went to see it. The Fountain of the Four Rivers. A flawless tribute to water, Bernini's Fountain of the Four Rivers glorified the four major rivers of the Old World: the Nile, the Ganges, Danube, and Rio Plata. Water, Langdon thought, the final marker. It was perfect. And even more perfect, Langdon realized, the cherry on the cake, was that high atop Bernini's fountain stood a towering obelisk. Leaving confused firemen in his wake, Langdon ran across the church in the direction of Olivetti's lifeless body. 10:31 p.m., he thought. Plenty of time. It was the first instant all day that Langdon felt ahead of the game. Kneeling beside Olivetti, out of sight behind some pews, Langdon discreetly took possession of the commander's semi-automatic and walkie-talkie. Langdon knew he would call for help, but this was not the place to do it. The final altar of science needed to remain a secret for now. The media and fire department racing with sirens blaring to Piazza Navona would be no help at all. Without a word, Langdon slipped out the door and skirted the press, who were now entering the church in droves. He crossed Piazza Barberini. In the shadows, he turned on the walkie-talkie. He tried to hail Vatican City, but heard nothing but static. He was either out of range, or the transmitter needed some kind of authorization code. Langdon adjusted the complex dials and buttons to no avail. Abruptly, he realized his plan to get help was not going to work. He spun, looking for a payphone. None. The Vatican circuits were jammed anyway. He was alone. Feeling his initial surge of confidence decay, Langdon stood a moment and took stock of his pitiful state. Covered in bone dust, cut, deliriously exhausted and hungry. Langdon glanced back at the church. Smoke spiraled over the cupola, lit by the media lights and fire trucks. He wondered if he should go back and get help. Instinct warned him, however, that extra help, especially untrained help, would be nothing but a liability. If the Hashashin sees us coming, he thought of Vittoria, and knew this would be his final chance to face her captor. Piazza Navona, he thought, knowing he could get there in plenty of time and stake it out. He scanned the area for a taxi, but the streets were almost entirely deserted. Even the taxi drivers, it seemed, had dropped everything to find a television. Piazza Navona was only about a mile away, but Langdon had no intention of wasting precious energy on foot. He glanced back at the church, wondering if he could borrow a vehicle from someone. A fire truck, a press van. Be serious. Sensing options and minutes slipping away, Langdon made his decision. Pulling the gun from his pocket, he committed an act so out of character that he suspected his soul must now be possessed. Running over to a lone Citroen sedan idling at a stoplight, Langdon pointed the weapon through the driver's open window.
40!
He yelled. The trembling man got out. Langdon jumped behind the wheel and hit the gas. Chapter 101
Gunther Glick sat on a bench in a holding tank inside the office of the Swiss Guard. He prayed to every god he could think of, "Please, let this not be a dream." It had been the scoop of his life, the scoop of anyone's life. Every reporter on Earth wished he were Glick right now.
"You are awake," he told himself, "and you are a star. Dan Rather is crying right now."
Macri was beside him, looking a little bit stunned. Glick didn't blame her. In addition to exclusively broadcasting the Camerlengo's address, she and Glick had provided the world with gruesome photos of the cardinals and of the Pope. That tongue! As well as a live video feed of the antimatter canister counting down.
Incredible!
Of course, all of that had all been at the Camerlengo's behest. So that was not the reason Glick and Macri were now locked in a Swiss Guard holding tank. It had been Glick's daring addendum to their coverage that the guards had not appreciated. Glick knew the conversation on which he had just reported was not intended for his ears, but this was his moment in the sun, another Glick scoop.
"The 11th hour Samaritan,"
Macri groaned on the bench beside him, clearly unimpressed. Glick smiled.
"Brilliant, wasn't it?"
"Brilliantly dumb."
"She's just jealous," Glick knew.
Shortly after the Camerlengo's address, Glick had again by chance been in the right place at the right time. He'd overheard Rocher giving new orders to his men. Apparently Rocher had received a phone call from a mysterious individual who Rocher claimed had critical information regarding the current crisis. Rocher was talking as if this man could help them and was advising his guards to prepare for the guests' arrival. Although the information was clearly private, Glick had acted as any dedicated reporter would, without honor. He found a dark corner, ordered Macri to fire up a remote camera, and he'd reported the news.
"Shocking new developments in God's City,"
he had announced, squinting his eyes for added intensity. Then he'd gone on to say that a mystery guest was coming to Vatican City to save the day. The 11th hour Samaritan, Glick had called him. A perfect name for the faceless man appearing at the last moment to do a good deed. The other networks had picked up the catchy soundbite, and Glick was yet again immortalized.
"I'm brilliant," he mused. "Peter Jennings just jumped off a bridge."
Of course, Glick hadn't stopped there. While he had the world's attention, he had thrown in a little of his own conspiracy theory for good measure.
"Brilliant, utterly brilliant."
"You screwed us," Macri said. "You totally blew it."
"What do you mean? I was great."
Macri stared disbelievingly.
"Former President George Bush? An Illuminatus?"
Glick smiled.
"How much more obvious could it be?
George Bush was a well-documented 33-degree Mason. And he was the head of the CIA when the agency closed their Illuminati investigation for lack of evidence. And all those speeches about 1,000 points of light and a new world order? Bush was obviously Illuminati."
"And that bit about CERN," Macri chided. "You're going to have a very big line of lawyers outside your door tomorrow."
"CERN? Oh, come on, it's so obvious. Think about it. The Illuminati disappear off the face of the Earth in the 1950s, at about the same time CERN is founded. CERN is a haven for the most enlightened people on Earth. Tons of private funding. They build a weapon that can destroy the Church, and, oops, they lose it."
"So you tell the world that CERN is the new home base of the Illuminati?"
"Obviously. Brotherhoods don't just disappear. The Illuminati had to go somewhere. CERN is a perfect place for them to hide. I'm not saying everyone at CERN is Illuminati. It's probably like a huge Masonic lodge, where most people are innocent, but the upper echelons."
"Have you ever heard of slander, Glick?
liability. Have you ever heard of real journalism?
Journalism? You were pulling bullshit out of thin air. I should have turned off the camera.
And what the hell was that crap about CERN's corporate logo? Satanic symbology. Have you lost your mind?
Glick smiled. Macri's jealousy was definitely showing. The CERN logo had been the most brilliant coup of all. Ever since the Camerlengo's address, all the networks were talking about CERN and antimatter. Some stations were showing the CERN corporate logo as a backdrop. The logo seemed standard enough, two intersecting circles representing two particle accelerators, and five tangential lines representing particle injection tubes. The whole world was staring at this logo, but it had been Glick, a bit of a symbologist himself, who had first seen the Illuminati symbology hidden in it.
"You're not a symbologist," Macri chided. "You're just one lucky-ass reporter. You should have left the symbology to the Harvard guy."
"The Harvard guy missed it," Glick said. "The Illuminati's significance in this logo is so obvious." He was beaming inside. Although CERN had lots of accelerators, their logo showed only two. Two is the Illuminati number of duality. Although most accelerators had only one injection tube, the logo showed five. Five is the number of the Illuminati pentagram. Then had come the coup, the most brilliant point of all. Glick pointed out that the logo contained a large numeral six, clearly formed by one of the lines and circles. And when the logo was rotated, another six appeared, and then another. The logo contained three sixes. 666, the devil's number, the mark of the beast. Glick was a genius. Macri looked ready to slug him. The jealousy would pass, Glick knew, his mind now wandering to another thought. If CERN was Illuminati headquarters, was CERN where the Illuminati kept their infamous Illuminati diamond? Glick had read about it on the Internet, a flawless diamond born of the ancient elements with such perfection that all those who saw it could only stand in wonder. Glick wondered if the secret whereabouts of the Illuminati diamond might be yet another mystery he could unveil tonight.
Chapter 102. Piazza Navona, Fountain of the Four Rivers. Nights in Rome, like those in the desert, can be surprisingly cool, even after a warm day. Langdon was huddled now on the fringes of Piazza Navona, pulling his jacket around him. Like the distant white noise of traffic, a cacophony of news reports echoed across the city. He checked his watch. 15 minutes. He was grateful for a few moments of rest. The piazza was deserted. Bernini's masterful fountain sizzled before him with a fearful sorcery. The foaming pool sent a magical mist upward, lit from beneath by underwater floodlights. Langdon sensed a cool electricity in the air. The fountain's most arresting quality was its height. The central core alone was over 20 feet tall, a rugged mountain of travertine marble riddled with caves and grottos through which the water churned. The entire mound was draped with pagan figures. Atop this stood an obelisk that climbed another 40 feet. Langdon let his eyes climb. On the obelisk's tip, a faint shadow blotted the sky. A lone pigeon perched silently.
A cross, Langdon thought, still amazed by the arrangement of the markers across Rome.
Bernini's Fountain of the Four Rivers was the last altar of science. Only hours ago, Langdon had been standing in the Pantheon, convinced the path of illumination had been broken, and he would never get this far. It had been a foolish blunder. In fact, the entire path was intact. Earth, air, fire, water. And Langdon had followed it, from beginning to end. Not quite to the end, he reminded himself. The path had five stops, not four. This fourth marker fountain somehow pointed to the ultimate destiny, the Illuminati's sacred lair, the Church of Illumination. Langdon wondered if the lair was still standing. He wondered if that was where the Hashashin had taken Vittoria. Langdon found his eyes probing the figures in the fountain, looking for any clue as to the direction of the lair. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Almost immediately, though, he was overcome by an unsettling awareness.
The fountain contained no angels whatsoever. It certainly contained none Langdon could see from where he was standing, and none he had ever seen in the past. The Fountain of the Four Rivers was a pagan work. The carvings were all profane. Humans, animals, even an awkward armadillo. An angel here would stick out like a sore thumb. Is this the wrong place? He considered the cruciform arrangement of the four obelisks. He clenched his fists. This fountain is perfect. It was only 10:46 p.m. when a black van emerged from the alleyway on the far side of the piazza. Langdon wouldn't have given it a second look, except that the van drove with no headlights. Like a shark patrolling a moonlit bay, the vehicle circled the perimeter of the piazza. Langdon hunkered lower, crouched in the shadows beside the huge stairway leading up to the Church of St. Agnes in Agony. He gazed out at the piazza, his pulse climbing. After making two complete circuits, the van banked inward toward Bernini's fountain. It pulled abreast of the basin, moving laterally along the rim until its side was flush with the fountain. Then it parked, its sliding door positioned only inches above the churning water. Mist billowed. Langdon felt an uneasy premonition. Had the Hashashin arrived early? Had he come in a van? Langdon had imagined the killer escorting his last victim across the piazza on foot, like he had at St. Peter's, giving Langdon an open shot. But if the Hashashin had arrived in a van, the rules had just changed. Suddenly, the van's side door slid open. On the floor of the van, contorted in agony, lay a naked man. The man was wrapped in yards of heavy chains. He thrashed against the iron links, but the chains were too heavy. One of the links bisected the man's mouth like a horse's bit, stifling his cries for help. It was then that Langdon saw the second figure, moving around behind the prisoner in the dark, as though making final preparations. Langdon knew he had only seconds to act. Taking the gun, he slipped off his jacket and dropped it on the ground. He didn't want the added encumbrance of a tweed jacket, nor did he have any intention of taking Galileo's diagramma anywhere near the water. The document would stay here, where it was safe and dry. Langdon scrambled to his right. Circling the perimeter of the fountain, he positioned himself directly opposite the van. The fountain's massive centerpiece obscured his view. Standing, he ran directly toward the basin. He hoped the thundering water was drowning his footsteps. When he reached the fountain, he climbed over the rim and dropped into the foaming pool. The water was waist-deep and like ice. Langdon gritted his teeth and plowed through the water. The bottom was slippery, made doubly treacherous by a stratum of coins thrown for good luck. Langdon sensed he would need more than good luck. As the mist rose all around him, he wondered if it was the cold or the fear that was causing the gun in his hand to shake. He reached the interior of the fountain and circled back to his left. He waded hard, clinging to the cover of the marble forms. Hiding himself behind a huge carved form of a horse, Langdon peered out. The van was only 15 feet away. The Hashashin was crouched on the floor of the van, hands planted on the cardinal's chain-clad body, preparing to roll him out the open door into the fountain. Waist-deep in water, Robert Langdon raised his gun and stepped out of the mist, feeling like some sort of aquatic cowboy making a final stand. "Don't move!" His voice was steadier than the gun. The Hashashin looked up. For a moment he seemed confused, as though he had seen a ghost. Then his lips curved into an evil smile. He raised his arms in submission. "And so it goes. Get out of the van. You look wet. You're early. I am eager to return to my prize." Langdon leveled the gun. "I won't hesitate to shoot." "You've already hesitated." Langdon felt his finger tighten on the trigger. The cardinal lay motionless now. He looked exhausted, moribund. "Untie him." "Forget it. You've come for the woman. Do not pretend otherwise." Langdon fought the urge to end it right there.
Where is she? Somewhere safe, awaiting my return. She's alive, Langdon felt a ray of hope. At the Church of Illumination? The killer smiled. You will never find its location. Langdon was incredulous. The lair is still standing. He aimed the gun. Where? The location has remained secret for centuries. Even to me, it was only revealed recently. I would die before I break that trust. I can find it without you. An arrogant thought. Langdon motioned to the fountain. I've come this far. So have many. The final step is the hardest.
Langdon stepped closer, his footing tentative beneath the water. The Hashashin looked remarkably calm, squatting there on the back of the van with his arms raised over his head. Langdon aimed at his chest, wondering if he should simply shoot and be done with it.
No, he knows where Vittoria is. He knows where the antimatter is. I need information.
From the darkness of the van, the Hashashin gazed out at his aggressor and couldn't help but feel an amused pity. The American was brave, that he had proven, but he was also untrained. That he had also proven. Valor without expertise was suicide. There were rules of survival, ancient rules, and the American was breaking all of them. You had the advantage, the element of surprise. You squandered it. The American was indecisive, hoping for backup, most likely, or perhaps a slip of the tongue that would reveal critical information.
Never interrogate before you disable your prey. A cornered enemy is a deadly enemy. The American was talking again, probing, maneuvering. The killer almost laughed out loud. This is not one of your Hollywood movies. There will be no long discussions at gunpoint before the final shootout. This is the end. Now.
Without breaking eye contact, the killer inched his hands across the ceiling of the van until he found what he was looking for. Staring dead ahead, he grasped it. Then he made his play. The motion was utterly unexpected. For an instant, Langdon thought the laws of physics had ceased to exist. The killer seemed to hang weightless in the air as his legs shot out from beneath him, his boots driving into the cardinal's side and launching the chain-laden body out the door. The cardinal splashed down, sending up a sheet of spray. Water dousing his face, Langdon realized too late what had happened. The killer had grasped one of the van's roll bars and used it to swing outward. Now the Hashashin was sailing toward him, feet first, through the spray. Langdon pulled the trigger, and the silencer spat. The bullet exploded through the toe of the Hashashin's left boot. Instantly, Langdon felt the soles of the Hashashin's boots connect with his chest, driving him back with a crushing kick. The two men splashed down in a spray of blood and water. As the icy liquid engulfed Langdon's body, his first cognition was pain. Survival instinct came next. He realized he was no longer holding his weapon. It had been knocked away. Diving deep, he groped along the slimy bottom. His hand gripped metal. A handful of coins. He dropped them. Opening his eyes, Langdon scanned the glowing basin. The water churned around him like a frigid jacuzzi. Despite the instinct to breathe, fear kept him on the bottom. Always moving. He didn't know from where the next assault would come. He needed to find the gun. His hands groped desperately in front of him. You have the advantage, he told himself. You're in your element. Even in a soaked turtleneck, Langdon was an agile swimmer. Water is your element. When Langdon's fingers found metal a second time, he was certain his luck had changed. The object in his hand was no handful of coins. He gripped it and tried to pull it toward him, but when he did, he found himself gliding through the water. The object was stationary. Langdon realized even before he coasted over the cardinal's writhing body that he had grasped part of the metal chain that was weighing the man down. Langdon hovered a moment, immobilized by the sight of the terrified face staring up at him from the floor of the fountain. Jolted by the life in the man's eyes, Langdon reached down and grabbed the chains, trying to heave him toward the surface. The body came slowly, like an anchor. Langdon pulled harder. When the cardinal's head broke the surface, the old man gasped a few sucking, desperate breaths. Then, violently, his body rolled, causing Langdon to lose his grip on the slippery chains. Like a stone, Baja went down again and disappeared beneath the foaming water. Langdon dove, eyes wide in the liquid murkiness. He found the cardinal. This time, when Langdon grabbed on, the chains across Baja's chest shifted, parting to reveal a further wickedness. A word stamped in seared flesh. Water. An instant later, two boots strode into view. One was gushing blood. Chapter 103. As a water polo player, Langdon had endured more than his fair share of underwater battles. The competitive savagery that raged beneath the surface of a water polo pool, away from the eyes of the referees, could rival even the ugliest wrestling match. Langdon had been kicked, scratched, held, and even bitten once by a frustrated defenseman from whom Langdon had continuously twisted away. Now, though, thrashing in the frigid water of Bernini's fountain, Langdon knew he was a long way from the Harvard pool. He was fighting not for a game, but for his life. This was the second time they had battled. No referees here, no rematches. The arms driving his face toward the bottom of the basin thrust with a force that left no doubt that it intended to kill. Langdon instinctively spun like a torpedo, break the hold, but the grip torqued him back. His attacker enjoying an advantage no water polo defenseman ever had, 2 feet on solid ground. Langdon contorted, trying to get his own feet beneath him. The Hashashin seemed to be favoring one arm, but nonetheless his grip held firm. It was then that Langdon knew he was not coming up. He did the only thing he could think of to do. He stopped trying to surface. If you can't go north, go east. Marshaling the last of his strength, Langdon dolphin-kicked his legs and pulled his arms beneath him in an awkward butterfly stroke. His body lurched forward. The sudden switch in direction seemed to take the Hashashin off guard. Langdon's lateral motion dragged his captor's arms sideways, compromising his balance. The man's grip faltered, and Langdon kicked again. The sensation felt like a tow line had snapped. Suddenly, Langdon was free. Blowing the stale air from his lungs, Langdon clawed for the surface. A single breath was all he got. With crashing force, the Hashashin was on top of him again, palms on his shoulders, all of his weight bearing down. Langdon scrambled to plant his feet beneath him, but the Hashashin's legs swung out, cutting Langdon down. He went under again. Langdon's muscles burned as he twisted beneath the water. This time his maneuvers were in vain. Through the bubbling water, Langdon scanned the bottom, looking for the gun. Everything was blurred. The bubbles were denser here. A blinding light flashed in his face as the killer wrestled him deeper toward a submerged spotlight bolted on the floor of the fountain. Langdon reached out, grabbing the canister. It was hot. Langdon tried to pull himself free, but the contraption was mounted on hinges and pivoted in his hand. His leverage was instantly lost. The Hashashin drove him deeper still. It was then Langdon saw it. Poking out from under the coins directly beneath his face, a narrow black cylinder, the silencer of Olivetti's gun. Langdon reached out, but as his fingers wrapped around the cylinder, he did not feel metal. He felt plastic. When he pulled, the flexible rubber hose came flopping toward him like a flimsy snake. It was about 2 feet long, with a jet of bubbles surging from the end. Langdon had not found the gun at all. It was one of the fountain's many harmless spumanti, bubble makers. Only a few feet away, Cardinal Baja felt his soul straining to leave his body. Although he had prepared for this moment his entire life, he had never imagined the end would be like this. His physical shell was in agony, burned, bruised, and held underwater by an immovable weight. He reminded himself that this suffering was nothing compared to what Jesus had endured. He died for my sins. Baja could hear the thrashing of a battle raging nearby. He couldn't bear the thought of it. His captor was about to extinguish yet another life, the man with kind eyes, the man who had tried to help. As the pain mounted, Baja lay on his back and stared up through the water at the black sky above him. For a moment he thought he saw stars. It was time. Releasing all fear and doubt, Baja opened his mouth and expelled what he knew would be his final breath. He watched his spirit gurgle heavenward in a burst of transparent bubbles. Then, reflexively, he gasped. The water poured in like icy daggers to his sides. The pain lasted only a few seconds. Then, peace. The Hashashin ignored the burning in his foot and focused on the drowning American, whom he now held pinned beneath him in the churning water. Finish it fully. He tightened his grip, knowing this time Robert Langdon would not survive. As he predicted, his victim's struggling became weaker and weaker. Suddenly, Langdon's body went rigid. He began to shake wildly. Yes, the Hashashin mused. The rigors, when the water first hits the lungs. The rigors, he knew, would last about 5 seconds. They lasted 6. Then, exactly as the Hashashin expected, his victim went suddenly flaccid. Like a great deflating balloon, Robert Langdon fell limp. It was over. The Hashashin held him down for another 30 seconds to let the water flood all of his pulmonary tissue. Gradually, he felt Langdon's body sink on its own accord to the bottom. Finally, the Hashashin let go. The media would find a double surprise in the Fountain of the Four Rivers. Taban! The Hashashin swore, clambering out of the fountain and looking at his bleeding toe. The tip of his boot was shredded, and the front of his big toe had been sheared off. Angry at his own carelessness, he tore the cuff from his pant leg and rammed the fabric into the toe of his boot. Pain shot up his leg.
Ibn al-Kab!
He clenched his fists and rammed the cloth deeper. The bleeding slowed until it was only a trickle. Turning his thoughts from pain to pleasure, the Hashashin got into his van. His work in Rome was done. He knew exactly what he would do to soothe his discomfort. Vittoria Vetra was bound and waiting. The Hashashin, even cold and wet, felt himself stiffen.
I have earned my reward.
Across town, Vittoria awoke in pain. She was on her back. All of her muscles felt like stone. Tight, brittle. Her arms hurt. When she tried to move, she felt spasms in her shoulders. It took her a moment to comprehend her hands were tied behind her back. Her initial reaction was confusion. Am I dreaming? But when she tried to lift her head, the pain at the base of her skull informed her of her wakefulness. Confusion transforming to fear, she scanned her surroundings. She was in a crude stone room, large and well-furnished, lit by torches. Some kind of ancient meeting hall. Old-fashioned benches sat in a circle nearby. Vittoria felt a breeze, cold now on her skin. Nearby, a set of double doors stood open, beyond them a balcony. Through the slits in the balustrade, Vittoria could have sworn she saw the Vatican. Chapter 104. Robert Langdon lay on a bed of coins at the bottom of the Fountain of the Four Rivers. His mouth was still wrapped around the plastic hose. The air being pumped through the spumante tube to froth the fountain had been polluted by the pump, and his throat burned. He was not complaining, though. He was alive. He was not sure how accurate his imitation of a drowning man had been, but having been around water his entire life, Langdon had certainly heard accounts. He had done his best. Near the end, he had even blown all the air from his lungs and stopped breathing so that his muscle mass would carry his body to the floor. Thankfully, the Hashashin had bought it and let go. Now, resting on the bottom of the fountain, Langdon had waited as long as he could wait. He was about to start choking. He wondered if the Hashashin was still out there. Taking an acrid breath from the tube, Langdon let go and swam across the bottom of the fountain until he found the smooth swell of the central core. Silently, he followed it upward, surfacing out of sight in the shadows beneath the huge marble figures. The van was gone. That was all Langdon needed to see. Pulling a long breath of fresh air back into his lungs, he scrambled back toward where Cardinal Baja had gone down. Langdon knew the man would be unconscious now, and chances of revival were slim, but he had to try. When Langdon found the body, he planted his feet on either side, reached down, and grabbed the chains wrapped around the cardinal. Then Langdon pulled. When the cardinal broke water, Langdon could see the eyes were already rolled upward, bulging. Not a good sign. There was no breath or pulse. Knowing he could never get the body up and over the fountain rim, Langdon lugged Cardinal Baja through the water and into the hollow beneath the central mound of marble. Here the water became shallow, and there was an inclined ledge. Langdon dragged the naked body up onto the ledge as far as he could. Not far. Then he went to work. Compressing the cardinal's chain-clad chest, Langdon pumped the water from his lungs. Then he began CPR, counting carefully, deliberately, resisting the instinct to blow too hard and too fast. For 3 minutes, Langdon tried to revive the old man. After 5 minutes, Langdon knew it was over. El Preferito, the man who would be Pope, lying dead before him. Somehow, even now, prostrate in the shadows on the semi-submerged ledge, Cardinal Baja retained an air of quiet dignity. The water lapped softly across his chest, seeming almost remorseful, as if asking forgiveness for being the man's ultimate killer, as if trying to cleanse the scalded wound that bore its name. Gently, Langdon ran a hand across the man's face and closed his upturned eyes. As he did, he felt an exhausted shudder of tears well from within. It startled him. Then, for the first time in years, Langdon cried.